So, here we are, Mr. Parry.
We
it is episode 8 of the On The Record podcast series, which seems to be going terribly well.
That's right.
We've been talking an awful lot about our adventures in America.
Yes.
For those who are wondering what's going to happen when we run out of stories about our adventures to America, first of all, I don't know when that's going to be.
No, we won't.
Because we've got so many adventures America to talk about.
Yeah.
Some of which, of course, we will never talk about.
Yes.
Because they must remain secret.
Absolutely.
Because we don't want to upset anyone who's
absolutely
still possibly alive.
Yeah, that's right.
Although you keep trying to do that very often.
That's right.
But we've also got loads of stories about Europe, probably stories about other parts of the world.
Maybe.
Fleet Street, you know.
Oh, I'm sure we have. But anyway, this is number 8, as you quite rightly say. It's quite a landmark one, because the reason why we started doing these in the first place was to interest people in the fact that we're going to have a show going on in New York.
That's
and we've
right
got some news about that right now.
Well, the show in New York, the tickets are on sale.
They are. They're now on sale.
You can go to the City Winery's website.
Yes.
Or their Twitter account, which is at City Winery.
Mm.
Or, of course, you can go to our website, twomikes.co.uk.
You certainly can.
And find a link to it. And if you manage to get to the show, what you can do is live stream it into your house.
Yes, you can.
Or your flat.
You can.
Or your shed.
You can.
Or your car.
Or onto your tablet.
Or into your private jet, your plane, your boat.
Anything you like.
Anything you like.
Anyway, listen, when we get to New York on September the 16th, although we'll be there a bit before that, I would
hopefully
think.
Hopefully a day before,
a day before. The first thing I'll do is get myself a copy of the New York Post, because that's the one thing I love doing. The minute I arrive in the Apple in Manhattan, is get a copy, because I regard that as being a daily reminder of life in New York City, okay?
It is.
And I love the paper, loved it for years. Used to cost 50 cents when I was there.
I've no idea what it costs now.
Exactly. Imagine paying 50 cents for a newspaper. And of course, it was the introduction of tabloid newspapers into American society. They'd never seen them before.
Funnily enough, you say that, but was the Daily News not a tabloid before the New York Post came along? I think it was.
It might have been in shape, but it never was in style, if you know what I mean.
Not.
It was a very serious paper.
One of the things that I came to sort of get to know, which, as you would have done, was at the beginning when I first went to New York and saw a paper like the Daily News.
Yeah.
It was very stuffy.
Yeah, very stuffy.
Before the Post came along. Yeah. Maybe you're right. And they used to have these terribly long stories, which, of course, in our tabloids we don't have.
Yeah, that's right.
Where you'd have to turn to page 95 to read the rest of it. And they used to use words like poll as short form for politician.
That's right.
Which I never got along with, you know.
Veep for vice president.
Veep, yeah.
That was the one we got
all
out
that
of
sort
that,
of
wasn't
things,
it?
Yeah.
All that kind of stuff. Mm. But anyway, so the New York Post, so they really turned journalism around. They introduced Bingo.
Bingo, yes.
Yeah, for the first time. Was it called Bingo or Wingo?
I think it was called Wingo.
Wingo, that's right. Yeah, and great
stories.
Well,
there was a real newspaper war, wasn't there, between the Post and the News, all of which lost massive amounts of money.
That's right, yeah.
And couldn't make a profit.
It was to establish your voice in Manhattan. But the great thing about New York Post is, of course, we knew most of the people who worked on it.
Yes, a lot of Brits and Australians.
Yeah, and our favourite person, without doubt, was old, the Aussie guy.
Steve Dunleavy.
Steve Dunleavy.
Yeah.
And Steve Dunleavy, for instance, would work sometimes for 3 days at his desk, because it was a 24-hour-a-day newspaper. Yeah. Just turning out new editions, you know, not a morning edition, not an evening edition, just the latest edition.
Yes.
Steve would sometimes sit there for 3 days at his desk organising everything, putting helicopters up in the sky to chase cars down freeways and all this kind of stuff. And then after 3 days, he'd turn to his assistant and say, "Aha, okay, mate, I'm just going out for a quick beer, be back here in a half an hour." And then a day and a half later, some Italian owner of a Italian restaurant would ring up and say, "Hey, you guys, I get Steve here.
He
I just saved him from drowning. He fell forward in soup,
and
nobody noticed. He's been here for the last day and a half, and he's had 16 bottles of wine and 24 beers and nothing to eat."
Well, Chris Oliver, who was another friend of ours, very, very good friend of ours, in fact, I saw him quite recently.
Yeah.
He was a reporter for the Post.
Yeah, of course
and,
he was. Yeah,
and
crime
he used
reporter.
To live, he used to live right, because the office down in those days, it's moved now
South
uptown,
Street.
Was down on South Street Seaport.
That's right.
Right by the Fulton Street Fish Market.
That's
so
right.
There was a terrible stench of fish, because
yeah.
it was genuinely a fish market.
It was,
you know?
Yeah.
And it was underneath the FDR and all that. And Chris had an apartment on the sort of underside of the Brooklyn Bridge.
That's right.
Because I remember going there one time to watch the fireworks, which were going off on the East River.
Yeah.
And they were going off literally above our heads, which was amazing.
Yeah.
But there was a bar down there, which was called, I can't remember what it was called, but it was open at like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
And Chris would pop in there
yeah,
before
his
shift
work.
Started at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, that's right.
And he'd have about 5 or 6 beers.
Yeah.
before he even went to work.
Oh, yeah, he would, yeah. But, I mean, that was Chris. Chris sometimes would say, hey, you want to come to my country house?
Yes.
And he'd get through. I mean, I don't know how he interpreted the American drink drive laws, but he'd get through
not as you and I would.
No,
I think.
No. A box of six packs on the way up.
Well,
I mean,
he's the only guy, right?
Yeah.
And I think I've told you this story before.
Yeah.
Who managed to do something which I've never seen done before.
Yeah.
We were driving up to play golf one day up in Delaware Water Gap.
Yeah.
And he was, in fact, doing as you suggested, having a beer while he was driving.
No, I mean, that was the definition of drinking and driving.
Drinking and driving. Yeah. He's drinking a beer while he's driving.
Yeah.
And suddenly the engine cut out, right?
Mm, mm.
And he called the... The engine just cut out.
On
and
the car.
Yeah, the car just kind of veered off to the side and he parked it on the hard shoulder of the motorway, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the he called the tow trucks and all that. He's like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. He said, I don't know what's wrong with the car. It turned out, right, that his bottle opener was attached to his key ring.
Right.
And while he'd opened the beer, he'd somehow managed to turn the ignition off.
Didn't he try and start it again?
Well, because he didn't realise.
No, no.
And when the guys turned up,
they
were like... Well, there's nothing wrong with the car.
Why didn't you start it?
He said, why don't give us your key? And he put the key in the ignition, started it, and it started fine.
I mean,
he switched off the engine while we were going.
Yeah.
Because he was using the bottle opener that was attached to the key.
Well, Chris was a remarkable man because he did invite us up to his country place quite a few times.
Yeah.
The A-frame,
yeah.
Now, the famous A-frame fire was all about Chris getting up there early on a Saturday and everybody arriving in their own cars.
Yes.
And we were all staying overnight somewhere local,
sure.
So, you know, there wasn't any drink driving problem there.
No.
Chris is the only guy I know who thought that was, like, allowed in America, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I remember he made this punch, right. And it was so strong, it was undrinkable. So he'd come and say, hey, you guys, and he'd scoop, like, you know, something like a half-pint glass into his bowl of punch and hand it to you. But if you took three sips of it, your lips were blistered.
It was like 97 octane.
It was like drinking rocket fuel. So nobody ever came back for a second.
Right.
In fact, took the first one out in the garden, poured it onto a plant, and then died.
Yes.
It was so strong.
Right.
So Chris got more and more of this down him because he was determined to drink it himself. And then he said, I don't know what's wrong with you guys. He said, I go to my way to make you feel welcome in my house. He says, I make these great concoctions for you. What do? You lot of bums. He says, well, you've had it. Now, for some unknown reason, and because his brain had gone, he was doing a barbecue outside.
Yeah.
We had a fire inside.
Yeah.
It was like September, you know, or something like that.
Was there not snow on the ground? Because I used
there might have been.
Because I used to go out there for skiing and stuff like that.
It might have been that late in the year, but I felt it was kind of September, October, something like that. Right, letting air. So I said, you guys don't deserve me. So he picked up his bowl of punch and he threw it on the fire. I mean, I don't know where he meant to throw it. I don't know if he meant to throw it in the garden or where, but he just was so annoyed with us all not drinking.
Yeah.
Of course, needless to say, boof. You know, the fire exploded right up the chimney and it was lapping around the wood and we barely avoided getting the house burned down, you know, because he was so enraged.
Incredible.
Yeah.
His brother Dick, of course, Dick Oliver, was a very well-distinguished newspaper journalist as well.
Very much so. Radio journalist as well.
He had been the Daily News' sort of news editor who got moved out sort of in the process of their modernisation and
That's
all that because he was a very old-fashioned guy.
He was.
And in fact, he died a little bit earlier on this year.
He did, unfortunately.
And he had this great phrase, which I didn't discover until, in fact, his obituary was written.
Yeah.
And it was something like, you know, the Hey Mabel effect was what he would say.
The Hey Mabel.
And what it meant was that if you're reading the paper in the morning, the husband turns to his wife and says, Hey Mabel, have you seen this?
Yeah.
And that would be the reason for the story, because it would be so, you know, unusual. But that's why it was in the paper.
Well, actually, when I was a news editor, I used to call it the Gee Whiz effect.
Yeah, similar.
Somebody looked at the paper and went, wow, gee whiz, look at that.
You know,
same sort of thing. I loved Dick. He
Dick
was a great,
was great
guy.
Yeah.
And I tell you what happened. I mean, Dick had a bit of a checkered sort of history with drinking and driving as well, really.
He did, yeah.
But you've got to remember, we're coming from an era now where almost everybody regarded it as like the litter laws, you know what I mean?
Well,
and that
honest,
does not excuse it. That
no,
does
of course not
excuse
not. But to be
it,
honest, the generation of people that we're talking about were the same in this country. It wasn't as if in America it was different. But in America, I think they were slightly behind us in terms
of
reforming their drink driving laws, because in America, everybody drives everywhere.
Everybody drives everywhere. And also, remember, the freedom of the individual, which is what the gun laws are based around, had the same sort of problem with their constitution.
Yes.
You know, are you allowed to tell somebody not to do this, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So, but I remember Dick used to park his car outside of Costello sometimes in Manhattan.
Yeah.
And he came in one day and I was... telling him about somebody, you know, somebody else. Somebody had done something, and I didn't realise that this person was an arch enemy of Dick's. I don't even know who he was.
Right.
And I said...
another journalist or something?
Yeah, another journalist had been talking about Dick behind his back.
Oh, right.
But I didn't realise he was talking behind his back.
Uh-huh.
And it was something to do with an allegation that Dick was seeing somebody, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
That sort of thing. Mm. And
somebody should have been seen.
Somebody should have been seen. Uh-huh. Yeah, and Dick said he better not come anywhere near me and tell that story. I said, why? He says... he'll get the baseball bat treatment, okay?
Oh, really?
And I thought he was joking.
Yeah.
But then when Dick had a few more, he got more incensed about this story. He went out and he brought his baseball bat in.
Right.
And he started banging it on the on the counter in Costello's.
Yeah.
And it's a good job the guy didn't come in.
Because
if he had done, I think Dick would have said about him.
Well, funnily enough, he also had something which I'd never seen anyone have before. He always drove a Subaru. For some reason, the Oliver family all had Subarus.
Subaru cars, like Japanese.
Yeah, Japanese. Yeah. And he had a sort of sports Subaru. But he also had a blue light. A police blue light, because he was very well in with the cops.
Yeah, that's right.
Because one of our other great friends, of course, was the guy who was the PR for the NYPD.
Yes, that's right.
Whose son...
Is that Tony?
Not Tony. No, Tony was the AT&T guy.
Oh, that's right. He was,
This was the guy who later went on to have some kids, and one of his children became a massive star in Hollywood, Ed Burns.
Oh, Ed Burns,
is his name.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And Ed Burns, the director, is his son.
That's right.
And he now lives in this massive mansion in Florida.
Who, father or son?
Father.
Oh, really?
And he once rang me up, actually, a few years back.
So he's living off his son's wealth, is he?
Well, I think he was representing his son for a while, because he retired from the police office. Police scenario.
Became his son's agent.
But he was a great guy to know, because they're always filming things in New York.
Yes.
So you could always ring Ed Burns up and go, where are they filming such and such a movie? Wall Street, today. So if you wanted to go down like doorstep Michael Michael Douglas or Michael J. Fox or anyone, or Madonna when they were filming, he'd tell you exactly where they were.
Well, I actually saw, you know, the last scene in Romancing the Stone?
Oh, yeah.
We're romancing the stone.
Yeah, don't sing. For God's sake.
The last scene is of the yacht. On the trailer.
And he's got it outside her apartment, Kathleen Turner's apartment.
Yeah, because he eventually got the diamond out of the alligator, and that's why he was brandishing a pair of alligator boots.
That's right.
And cashed in on it and was bringing the wealth back to Kathleen Turner.
Right.
I saw that being made.
Uh-huh.
I came down one day, it was just past 42nd Street where our offices were, and I said, why is it all closed off and what's that yacht doing there? Mm. And they was making the film.
Yeah,
they did it all the time, didn't they? They had a whole division, didn't they, the NYPD, to close off roads for movies.
They did, and so Ed was very helpful in that way, and also whenever we needed somebody, say a lot of the photographers would call me and say, you know, can you find out where such and such is being filmed, because we want to try and get some pictures of whoever and flog them, which is what they did. But Dick and he were very, very good friends. I think they were old school buddies or something like that from Queens.
Sure.
And so Dick, for some reason, because he was in that, as a lot of people were in those days, the Police Benevolent Association.
That's
if you had that on the back of your car, you had a sticker, it meant basically you never got tickets for anything.
You never got stopped
because
or anything.
If they did stop, they'd be very helpful. But he had a blue light, because we were sitting once in the Midtown Tunnel,
right?
I think, going out to play golf somewhere, and he's like, watch this. And he took this blue light out of his dashboard, put it on the top of the car, turned it on, And then he had a little siren type
and
effect.
And then suddenly started weaving through the traffic.
Yeah, and he put it on and started with the siren, and people started getting out of the way.
Mm.
And we suddenly got through the traffic.
Fantastic, that. We
Which
need one
must
of those
have been
here.
Incredibly illegal.
We're going to need one of those next week when we...
very possibly.
..got to make a journey across town.
Very possibly.
Yeah. But, I mean, as much as I loved the... Oh, the other guy that I loved at the Post was the photographer. The picture editor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, Bob Young.
Bob Young, that's right. Bob
Young. Who was a northern guy from... Was he from Newcastle?
Well, he was from actually Middlesbrough.
Oh, was he? Yeah, right, okay. He was
from the North East, but he was from Middlesbrough. He used to talk in very tiny. And he wasn't... Bob was never the life and soul of the party, so he had a few drinks. And in fact, he was actually...
He was quite measured, wasn't he?
He was quite measured, and he was quite distant, really, from the revelries of the newspaper world, till he had a few drinks.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember once he... Philip Finn, our erstwhile colleague, R.I.P., Phil, he used to throw a thrash most New Year's Eves. I don't know if you ever went
to one. Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Well, they bring out the haggis dipped in whiskey and all
that.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah. And I remember we all got round there one New Year's Eve. It was great. It was
up
great
on, like,
fun.
58th Street they lived, didn't they?
He lived on 58th. He lived very near, the big store.
Bloomies. And the Queensborough Bridge and all that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he did, yeah. And but there was a great sense of camaraderie there, because we were all Brits in New York.
Yeah.
We were all in the newspaper industry or the radio industry. And everybody loved each other on New Year's Eve, no matter what had been going on.
Yeah.
So I remember Bob, came in, and then he had a few drinks, and then Phil told him some sort of a joke, and he went ho 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 ho, and he fell back onto a not a couch but an armchair. The armchair pitched over backwards and smashed this very expensive light that Anne-Marie, who is Phil's wife, obviously, had bought only a few days ago from Bloomingdale's, for Christmas to light up the apartment for this party. And it blew up. I mean, she told me it took her weeks to get all the fragments of glass out of the place. But I mean, and it caused... it was like a bomb explosion. Yeah. It really was.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, Bob was so terribly...
mortified, he must have been.
Well... especially when he sobered up the next day and found out what about the damage and all that. But he was a great guy, and he had this propensity, whenever there was a great story on, to issue the words at his picture desk, "Get a chopper up."
Yeah.
He loved that.
Well, he was the guy that rang Costello's, funnily enough, the day that big Paul Castellano got assassinated outside of Sparks.
Right.
I was in the pub with Mickey Brennan.
Yeah, he was a photographer, obviously.
And he was a photographer, and the phone rang, and it was the phone in the booth, And the guys picked it up behind the bar, and it was like, and obviously, because the great thing was, they always knew if Mickey Brennan was around in New York City, he was probably in the pub.
That's right.
Because it was about, I don't know, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And Mickey took the call, and he came back to me and he said, "Oh, that was Bob Young calling from the New York Post," because they were so far downtown.
That's right.
Bob had heard it, because one of the things that they had in New York newspapers was something we don't have, which was the police radio.
That's right.
So they could sit there and listen to the cops actually talking to each other. So they'd obviously been told that there was this gun incident on 45th Street. Mm. And so Mickey said to me, "Apparently Big Paul Castellano's just been shot around the corner outside of Sparks." He said, "I'm going around to take a picture. You want to come?" And I'm like, "Yeah, okay."
Exactly.
So we both walked around. Incredible. And we got there before anybody. And Mickey got the picture, and we've seen the picture since. You know, he got page one in the New York Post. It's been used all around the world of the guy just with his feet in the car, his head on the pavement, blood running down the street.
Right.
And the guys who assassinated him literally just dropped the guns and walked off.
They dropped the guns and walked into the sort of midtown that's right.
pedestrian traffic. Yes. It was rush hour.
That's right, yeah.
And nobody ever caught them. They've never been caught to this day.
That's right. They just evaporated into the New York
and the chauffeur hubbub. Had the shot, and he was still sitting in the car, with his practically his hands on the steering wheel, bullet right in the middle of his forehead.
So they did the chauffeur as well as Castellano.
Yeah.
And you got there before any official authority arrived.
Yep.
So Mickey must have taken 100 pictures.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. And I mean, you'll see that if you go looking it on the internet, you'll find the big Paul Castellano. And he had been down at the courthouse downtown giving evidence, because he had turned state's evidence.
Yeah.
And so he was a rat.
I see.
And so they thought, well, we don't want this guy telling any more stories.
No,
we'll just gun him down.
That's right.
We'll
go and get him.
Yeah. It gives me chills even now thinking about it.
Do you know what? Very similar to that. I did a story, and it was I got it from the New York Times. The New York Times was such a dull newspaper compared to the New York Post.
Yeah.
New York Daily News was quite dull, but the Times was awful. But it was a single column down the front, and I got a big page out of it in the Express that I was working for. Some guy who was a jeweler had also given information to the police about somebody trying to fence very expensive jewellery, And the people concerned were notoriously vicious. They weren't just like a nasty mob. They wouldn't just, you know, run you over or something like that. They were notoriously vicious.
They murder your entire family sort of people.
Or those sort of people. Yeah. And this jeweller, about 5 o'clock one winter's afternoon, was starting to take the trays out of his window, locking up for the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, it's Friday afternoon. And there was a tap, tap, tap like that on the window. And he looked up. And it was the lead number one hitman for this family he'd upset. And the guy just smiled at him. And the jeweller was so terrified that the guy was going to come in, he locked himself into the jewellery safe.
Right.
But he was in such a panic, he didn't realise he had no way of getting out.
Wow.
So he suffocated to death.
Oi.
So actually, the family
didn't kill the jeweller.
Yeah, he was there all weekend, So, well, no, he wasn't. He was there till about Saturday morning when people realised the lights were still on and all that kind of stuff. But he was there long enough to suffocate.
Mm.
And consequently, nobody ever got charged with murder because he voluntarily went into the safe.
Yeah.
The guy never even entered the shop.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, interesting that we're talking about sort of different characters, I suppose, that used to work in various ways. sideways. And Star, which was the magazine that I ended up working for, had just moved out of town into a place called Tarrytown.
That's right.
Which was interesting in itself because the building where they'd moved to had just been built. Literally, it was brand new.
Yeah.
When I went up to work there, next door was something called the some kind of, I think it was the Frank Sinatra Dinner Theatre or something like that, where people would go and have dinner and watch a play or whatever it was. But the, supposedly, the foundations of the building that the Star was built on had dead bodies buried in it because it was all built by the mob.
Oh, I see,
and the Teamsters and all this. Yeah, and supposedly there was a couple of characters, and it was around White Plains. That
so
kind
Jimmy
of
Hoffa might have been there.
It wasn't Jimmy Hoffa, but it was somebody like that.
Yeah,
that they reckoned was buried in the foundations of the building.
That's right, yeah.
Very bizarre.
Absolutely. The it reminded me of the Star, of course. We've mentioned, I think, Bob Smith, our colleague.
Yes, we have mentioned him.
And he came over one time on a Friday.
Yeah.
And no,
because in the old days when you were there, first of all, the Star offices were on Third Avenue, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Mm. And they moved up to Tarrytown, but Bob was out on the West Coast.
Ah, okay.
So Bob comes back, he became bureau chief, didn't he?
He did.
In LA.
Yeah.
So Bob's coming back from LA, he's ringing around trying to get a drink with somebody. It's a Thursday afternoon, actually.
Right.
And I said, yeah, hi, Bob, great, I haven't seen you for ages. You know, rough, tough Scotsman. Come on, Paul. Well, I wasn't known as Porky in those days. Come on, mate, let's go. So we went to Eamon Durant's.
Yeah.
So we met at 4 o'clock, and Bob said, oh, I'm only having a couple, he says, because I've got a big meeting with the bosses up at Tarrytown tomorrow, you know. It's all going well in LA, but, you know, they want to talk to me about budgets and
have you not told this one already?
I don't think I have.
I think you have.
Where he literally stayed all night and then had to be carried to the meeting the next day.
That's right.
I don't think I've told stories about Bob Smith, but not that one. But that was the problem with Tarrytown. It was a 25-minute train ride, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I had no idea. It was when I first started working up there, because it was actually a guy called Ian Walker. Not the Ian Walker that we know.
No, I know exactly
but
you
the
mean.
Other Ian Walker, who used to work for the Mail on Sunday, who's Kirsty Walker's father, actually.
Is that Kirsty Walker's father?
Yeah, it's Kirsty Walker's father, and he was...
Well, you know what happened to him, don't you?
Well, I know what example.
He fell off a mountain.
Well, he didn't fall off a mountain. He was climbing, and he had a terrible accident.
He fell off a mountain.
Well, he fell off a mountain, but that's not a very nice way to put it.
Do you know what his last words were?
His last words were, I'm going.
That's right.
I mean, I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh. Well, you did mean to laugh. No, the trouble is, he was walking with his brother on this mountain, and suddenly the mist descended.
That's right, yeah.
And they couldn't see anything. I don't know if you've ever been in that situation in Scotland.
No.
But it can happen so quickly.
Yes.
And what you're meant to do is just basically sit down and wait for the mist to clear.
Yeah.
But they didn't.
He kept walking.
And they kept walking, and he ended
slipped
up
over the
on
edge
the edge of
a
cliff.
Yeah.
And he was holding his brother's hand, and his brother just had to let him go because he couldn't hold
on any
longer.
He would have gone over with him, yeah.
Shocking story.
What a terrible thing to hear your brother say.
But he was the guy who was, funnily enough, he was the guy responsible for sending me to America because I used to play golf quite a lot with people like him.
Yes.
And I was kind of getting a bit sort of, I don't know, destabilised in London. There wasn't any jobs going. I was doing some shifts at the Sun. I was doing some shifts at the Mail. But there wasn't really anything happening. And we started talking about it. He said, why don't you go to America? And I said, well, I don't know where I'd be able to work there. And he said, oh, you go and work for the Star. And when I first went up there... in Tarrytown, I thought to myself, what is this? Is it the Tarrytown Star? Is it some local paper?
That's right, you didn't know what it was.
And I didn't know, and until I looked at the actual, you know, the page with all the staff names on it, and it said proprietor K.R. Murdoch.
That's right, yeah.
And I went, oh, okay, it's a Murdoch paper.
It's a Murdoch paper, and it's the rival, the National Enquirer.
And this makes a lot of sense.
The very famous National Enquirer.
And it was brilliant, and I had a lot of great times working for them.
Yeah, but you were so grateful to them, you suddenly decided to cop out and go and work for yourself.
No, I got fired.
Oh, you got fired?
Yeah, no, I got fired, because unfortunately I crashed a car.
Oh, that's right. Was that when the car turned over?
The car didn't turn over, but it did everything else but.
Yeah, exactly.
It was on the Palisades Parkway.
That's right.
And it was a wet night, and I was doing about 80 miles an hour in the fast lane. And a car pulled out in front of me doing 40, and I slammed the brakes on it. It was a big old Buick.
Yeah, yeah.
Rented car.
Sure.
And it just started spinning.
Yeah.
Spinning round and round and round. Yeah. Spun across the Central Reservation, spun across the northbound lanes.
Yeah.
I don't know how nobody hit me.
Yeah.
Ended up in a gully.
That's right.
Just above the Hudson River.
Oof.
And all four tyres blew out. The wheels were flat. The windscreen went.
That's not good.
And unfortunately, I had two people with me in the car.
Yeah.
A guy and his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Who were kind of on a bit of a jolly.
Yeah.
Who had a bottle of Jack Daniels.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was all a bit rough. And I was meant to be, and I couldn't have been employed by the Star because I was a foreigner.
No.
So they had to fire me.
That's right, yeah.
That'd be a week's money.
That's bad news.
23 years old.
23
what an
years
idiot.
Old. Yeah, what a, well, I mean, you've been an idiot ever since. you know, the first time I went and bought the New York Times on a Sunday.
Yeah.
I could not believe that when I, you know, went into a deli and I said, and, I mean, the size of it was unbelievable. It was
You need to lift weights to carry it
home. As a kid, I used to deliver the local weekly newspaper in Chester, you know, the Cheshire Observer.
Yeah.
And sometimes I would have like 12 in a bag slung over my shoulder because I was only about like, you know, 13 years of age or something. The New York Times is the same size as 12 copies of the Cheshire Observer and the Chester Chronicle. But anyway...
But
the,
you could buy loads of it on Saturday night, couldn't you? Because they printed it all so early.
Yeah, absolutely. They had to, And anyway, so I said, oh, I'll have one of these. I said, oh, crikey. I said, this is a bit of it. And the guy says, you know, it's OK. And he gave me a leaflet.
Yeah.
And the leaflet was issued by the New York Times, and it was... direction on how to read the New York Times on a Sunday.
Really?
It was such a huge paper. Right. They issued a pamphlet. Yeah, on where to go in the paper to find it.
Bizarre.
They couldn't even put that on the front page because that was so valuable, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they gave you a pamphlet with it, how to read the New York Times.
It's the only paper, by the way, that on the day after 9/11, they didn't, believe it or not, they didn't just do a massive breakbeat picture of the World Trade Center on fire.
No, it was all grey print.
They made it look like the paper every single day with one small picture and a load of words.
And sometimes they didn't even carry a picture. They carried an image.
Exactly.
You know, like an artist's cartoon.
Absolutely.
Not cartoon, an artist's image.
A drawing.
You know, if it was a story about Abraham Lincoln,
you
wouldn't have a picture of Abraham Lincoln. They'd get an artist to draw Abraham Lincoln.
Well, anyway, listen, we're out of time for this episode.
Oh, we're out of time? That's
a
pity, because I so enjoyed talking to you about these things.
Well,
you know?
Don't worry. We'll have another episode coming up next week.
You think so?
That'll be episode 9.
That'll be episode 9.
And so we've got more characters to bring to you.
Okay.
More tales of woe.
Okay. Well, as we've been talking about newspapers, do you mind if I end it with this?
Go on.
Read all about it!
We are the Two Mics. Turned out, right, that his bottle opener was attached to his key ring.
Right.
And while he'd opened the beer, he had somehow managed to turn the ignition off.
Didn't he try and start it again?
Well, because he didn't realise.
No.
And when the guys turned up,
they
were like, well, there's nothing wrong with the car.
Why didn't you start it?
And he said, why don't we give us your key? And he put the key in the ignition, started it, and it started fine.
He
switched off the engine while we were going because he was using the bottle opener that was attached to the key.
And the jeweller was so terrified that the guy was going to come in, he locked himself into the jewellery safe.
Right.
But he was in such a panic, he didn't realise he had no way of getting out.
Wow.
So he suffocated to death.
Oy.
So actually, the family
so
didn't
he was
kill
like in
the
there
jeweller.
All weekend.
Yeah, he was there all weekend, yeah. Phil told him some sort of a joke, and he went, ho, 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 and he fell back onto not a couch, but an armchair. The armchair pitched over backwards and smashed this very expensive light that Anne-Marie, who is Phil's wife, had bought only a few days ago from Bloomingdale's, for Christmas to light up the apartment for this party. And it blew up. I mean, she told me it took her weeks to get all the fragments of glass out of the place. You know what happened to him, don't you?
Well, I know what example.
He fell off a
mountain.
Oh, sorry.
Well, he didn't fall off a mountain. He was climbing and he had a terrible accident.
He fell off a mountain.
Well, he fell off a mountain, but that's not a very nice way to put it.